Okay, so thank you very much for that wonderful introduction, which I couldn't understand, but I'm sure it was very good. And I can very confidently say this is the first time that I've ever been preceded to a Dhamma talk by an elephant. That was amazing. Yeah. So it's very wonderful for me to be here and to have such a warm welcome and reception here. To get the chance to speak about Dhamma a little bit with you all. So as you've just heard, I've been living for the last 10 years mostly in Australia. And the last few weeks I've actually spent in Europe and teaching in mostly Germany and Norway. And one of the things that really struck me when I was teaching there, especially talking about meditation and so on, and here you're in some of the most developed countries in the world. People have very good education, good health, everything that you could want. So why do they come to meditation retreats? Why do they give up all of those things? Yeah? To come and sit and be still. Why is it that people who have achieved everything that you could want, everything that from an ordinary or worldly perspective is considered to be the good things of life. And yet when they've got those good things, they're not happy. They turn around, they want to give them up again. And they want to come and engage in this very peculiar habit that we have as Buddhists. I don't know if you've ever reflected about this, but in Buddhists, when we teach meditation, we think our idea of a good time is to come and to sit in a room together and not talk to each other. Right? Usually come to a good time is to come and chat and drink and dance and all of those things. That's a good time. But for us, a good time is to sit still, not do anything, not say anything. Ah, I had such a good time. There was nothing. But then what you see when people do that, what is it that's causing them suffering when we come, we sit meditation? Yeah? Just you, your meditation seat, nothing else. Are you happy when you do that? What is it that happens when there's nothing but you and your own mind? So the first thing that people come and say to you is, oh, I couldn't stop thinking. My mind keeps on going a million miles an hour. So is this a product of modern life? Yeah? Is it because we live in such fast-paced world that our minds are racing a million miles an hour all the time? Yeah? I remember there was one of my favorite sayings by a Buddhist scholar who said, that with our fast pace of life, rapid transport and communications, it's difficult for us to realize the same states of peace of mind that were realized by the sages in India in days gone by. Which I think we'll all agree is very true, right? That saying was said by Max Müller in the 1880s. Yeah? In the 1880s. Transport was so fast, yeah, those steam trains would really rip along, and communications, you could send a letter and it would arrive later that week. So it's difficult to have peace of mind. So what are we to do today? Yeah. Are we to give up? What is it that's disturbing us? What is just disturbing our mind? I spent many years in Thailand, and I remember one time we were staying in a monastery called Phujomgom. And Phujomgom is in one of the most remote parts of Thailand. It's actually, if you look at Thailand. They say the map of Thailand is like an elephant's head, yeah? And if you look at the sort of the back of the elephant's ear is like the easternmost point of Thailand. And that's where we were staying, on the Mekong River. Very remote place. And we were talking one time with the villagers there about their meditation. And we said, you know, how is your meditation going? And the villagers said, oh, Bhante, it's no good. When we try to sit meditation, I can't stop thinking about my water buffalo. So if it's not one thing, it's the other. We have our stresses and strains. But everybody has, whatever time you're in. So maybe we have to let go of our worries about our lives, our career, our job, our money, and all of those things. You know, if you look at most of the things that cause stress, you know, a lot of the things are family. Yeah? If you have problems with relations in the family, of course, that causes a lot of stress. Friends, whether, you know, your income, whether you can earn enough money and pay your debts, your bills, and so on. All of these are the things which cause stress. And they cause stress for everyone, modern times or ancient times. So sometimes when it comes to meditation, we think about letting go. We think that we have to let go in order to find peace. But how is it that we go about letting go? What kinds of things are we going to let go of? Of course, according to the Buddha, we should let go of those things that cause suffering. But it's not so easy to identify those things that cause suffering because we almost always focus on the symptoms. Yeah? We look at the surfaces of things and we react to the surfaces of things and we don't understand the causes of them. And so this is why when we feel suffering, we try to distract ourselves. We try to find one thing or another thing. We watch telly or you go to Facebook or you do something to just distract yourself from suffering, just to find that bit of peace, that bit of relief, even though it's just for a moment. And sometimes it seems that, you know, a good life or a happy life is a life where you can successfully distract yourself continually, yeah, and you just hope that you don't have to stop. And you notice that one of the most painful things in life is when you're forced to stop. You ever notice that? If you're in a traffic jam, yeah? Actually, being in a car in a traffic jam is no more uncomfortable than driving in a car, right? You're still sitting in the same seat, right? Physically it hasn't changed, and yet it's stressful. Yeah? Or if you have to wait in a queue. Yeah, waiting in a queue is very stressful. Why? Because you want to be somewhere else. And because you can't distract yourself. So one of the great Dhamma lessons, I think, is found in the American Declaration of Independence. It says that every person has an inalienable right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It's very precisely worded, okay? Life, we have a right to life. That's good. We have a right to liberty. This also is good. We don't actually have a right to happiness. Yeah? We have a right to pursue happiness. Yeah? You have a right to the pursuit, not to actually getting happiness. It's very, very precise, isn't it? That's exactly how our life is. We have our right to pursue happiness, to keep on chasing it, and never, ever finding it. Yeah. If we were to find happiness, yeah, the world would collapse. Happiness is the most dangerous thing for the world. Imagine if everybody was happy. Imagine if everybody today suddenly magically got enlightened. Oh, I'm just perfectly happy. Right? No more TV. Why would I bother watching TV? I'm happy already. Yeah. No more cigarettes, alcohol. No more fancy restaurants, fancy clothes. The fashion industry would die. Oh, I'm happy. I'll just wear whatever's around. The advertising industry would collapse. Our world would be in chaos overnight if everybody was happy. But it wouldn't matter because we'd all be happy about it, so it's okay. So our world is built on this pursuit. It's built on this assumption that we will always be seeking, always wanting. Of course, this is, the Buddha said, is the second noble truth. Right? It's that seeking, that wanting. And it's that very pursuit which means that we will never, ever, ever, ever find happiness. The faster you run, the further away it goes. But actually, the secret to happiness is no secret at all. It's not something which is really elusive. It's not something which is, there's no great mystery about it. You know, there are some basic things which, as human beings, which are part of a happy life. You know, first thing is we have sufficient material possessions or material supports. You know, the basic requisites that the Buddha spoke about. We have a place to stay that keeps the rain off and keeps us reasonably comfortable. And that doesn't have to be very much, you know. When I left Australia for the first time, I've travelled to Thailand and I ended up staying in these forest monasteries. And the forest monasteries there are very, very simple. And the little huts, the kutis I'd stay in, very often just a wooden floor, some bamboo walls, a leaf grass roof, and that's it. Yeah. No windows, not a bathroom or anything like that. Just a simple four walls, a wooden floor, bamboo, that's it. And I remember one time sitting in this hut and just looking around me and seeing the things that were in that hut. And I had my robes, my bowl, a cup for water, and a straw mat, and a candle and matches, one or two other things like that. And I looked around this hut and I was thinking, what do I need? What if I could have a fairy come to me and say, I'll grant you three wishes, what do you wish for? What would I wish for? I don't know. I couldn't think of anything that I wanted. But there was enough, okay? If you don't have those things, if you don't have enough food to eat, if you don't have medicine when you fall sick and so on, then obviously you will be suffering. But it doesn't take much of those things. And this is something actually, this is not just the Buddha's teaching, this is something that's been confirmed by countless studies in modern psychology, which all agree that, you know, beyond a certain point, money doesn't make you happy and material things don't make you happy. Many times people have studied this. To a certain degree, if your income is below a certain amount and you can't provide for those basics, then yes, there's insecurity and so on that causes unhappiness. But beyond that point, you're happy. So the material things is actually quite simple. And then you have other social things like having family and friends, good company to be in and so on. And so there are some other things like that. But the most important thing for happiness, according to the Buddha's teachings, is how we're using our mind. Now, when we come to look at our mind and look at how our mind works, it's something which is rather curious because it's not at all obvious. I mean, we live here in our own minds, don't we? Our minds is all we have. It's all we've ever known. All we've ever known is our own mind, our thoughts, our emotions, and all of these things. And yet we have so little understanding of how this works. Thoughts come and go. Emotions come and go. Intentions come and go. And we don't have any control or say about this, and very little understanding of how it works. So what the Buddha teaches us to do is to look at our minds and to understand cause and effect. It's a wonderful phrase in the Potapada Sutta, which to me sums up the Buddha's teachings on meditation very well. Like so many of the Buddha's teachings is so simple, it seems very obvious. But in fact, it's very profound. Sikkha eka sanya upajanti, sikkha eka sanya nirujanti. Because of a training, or through a training that some perceptions arise, and through a training that some perceptions cease. Yeah? Very, very important. Sikkha eka sanya upajanti. Because of a training that certain perceptions arise, because of a training that certain perceptions cease. So one of the things that this is teaching us is very simple, but very, very important. It's teaching us that we can change our minds. This itself is quite a radical notion. You know, if we look at how our Western psychology often comes from a background of thinking the mind is basically there. It's basically what you're given. Like we have this ridiculous notion in Western psychology of IQ, right? IQ is completely absurd. As if you have a thing which is intelligence that you can measure on a scale by doing some kind of test. It's completely absurd. So from a Buddhist point of view, there's no such thing as IQ. Your mind isn't just fixed in a certain way. And this is, again, what people will show you. If you look at how these IQ tests go, you'll get a different IQ in the morning than you will in the evening. You'll get a different one if you study how to do the test than if you don't. You'll get a different one if you've just had a cup of coffee before you're doing the test. Yeah? Your IQ changes all the time. It's not like you have a fixed thing which is your IQ. People say, oh, this person has an IQ of this and that person has an IQ of that. It's rubbish. No such thing. So from a Buddhist point of view, these functions of the mind, functions like wisdom, intelligence, compassion, loving kindness and so on, these are not innate qualities that somebody just has in some fixed amount. But these are things to be trained. They are properties which evolve and change and develop in our minds. They can be different from one moment to the next. You know that, don't you? You know that sometimes you can act with so much wisdom, and sometimes you act completely stupidly. Yeah. Yeah. Wisdom is not something that you have. Wisdom is something that you do. Ah, very important. Yeah? Loving kindness is not something that you have. Loving kindness is something that you do. Yeah? It's very interesting when the Buddha was talking about different mental qualities, that there's this way, one of the ways that he would use to talk about it is he would give definitions where he would define a noun in terms of its verb. Okay? So, vedayati vedana, for example. So you say, one experiences, one feels, that's why it's called feeling. Yeah? Or sanjanati sanya. It's sanya because It's perception because one perceives. So when you look at that kind of definition, you think, oh, that's kind of, it's not really saying anything. It's just using one word to say the other word. But the point is, what's changed? What's changed is a noun has changed to a verb. A thing has changed to an action. Right? So what the Buddha is saying with these definitions is saying that these things are not fixed properties that your mind have. They're behaviors. They are things that you do. And yet we constantly get stuck in this way of looking at our minds and way of thinking at our minds that assumes that everything's fixed. And because we assume this is what we're given, because we assume that our minds are somehow fixed, when we experience suffering, we blame the other. We blame some kind of outside condition. Right? It's what he said, that's what made me suffer. It's the bad food, that was what made me suffer. It's the government, that's what made me suffer. I don't know if Sri Lankan people complain about the government a lot, but in Australia we do, so I assume people around the world are usually like to complain about their government, so... So we always blame from outside. We always criticize from outside because that's much easier than admitting that happiness and suffering are not things that happen to us. We are not victims of happiness and suffering. We are the agents. We are the ones who cause happiness and suffering. We are the ones who create it and bring it into being, both for ourselves and for others. So think about how this applies in your meditation. When we come down, we sit in meditation, we're very quiet, very peaceful, there's nothing all around us. Maybe a little bit of background noise. But basically we're quiet and we're still. And yet still we suffer. Sometimes we suffer more, right? Sometimes you come to sit meditation, it should be my peaceful time. And everything gets worse. I can feel everything so much more intensely. Actually, all of those things that you were trying to escape from, all the things you were trying to hide from, they come and they hunt you down. Yeah? That's why we always want to distract ourselves. We're always afraid of feeling. So this is one of the first things we have to learn if we want to learn to meditate, is don't be afraid. Don't be afraid of anything that happens. When you're sitting meditation, you have to be completely open to whatever is going to go on. You know, when we're selling meditation, when we're doing the marketing for meditation, we always say, oh, you'll be happy and you'll be peaceful and loving kindness and all of these words, you know. It's like they put on the poster there, it's like, oh, loving kindness and stuff. And that's just to get you into the hall so we can sort of talk to you and stuff, right? But when you actually sit and meditate, yes, sometimes it's like that, right? Yeah, sometimes not so much, yeah? Sometimes those feelings can be so vivid. So much reality in your meditation. So don't be afraid of that. Don't shy away from it. Don't think there's something wrong, yeah? Because I'm not feeling happy. It's okay. It's okay to not be happy. Yeah. It's all right to suffer. It's okay. It's just a feeling. It'll come, it'll go. You know, I can still feel this myself when I'm having to deal with a difficult situation or something like that. You know, have a difficult conversation with somebody or something like that, and sometimes you go and you sit meditation, and then you realize, oh, actually, I've been trying to avoid that. I've been trying to avoid that situation or that person. And then you sort of look into your heart and you look at the feelings that's going on there, and you realize, oh, actually, it's okay. It's just a feeling. Sometimes you feel happy, sometimes you feel sad. Yeah. On the retreat I just taught in Germany, there was one lady who was on the retreat who was, you know, been suffering from depression for such a long time. And that's all she'd ever known, was this kind of feeling of darkness in her own heart, this feeling of very strong depression. And it's very difficult for somebody like that to be on a meditation retreat, and she comes along and says, how do I get rid of this feeling? Yeah? How do I make this feeling go away? And I said, don't make the feeling go away. Why do you want to make the feeling go away? The feeling is part of who you are. Yeah? If you're saying to that feeling, go away, then you're saying, I want part of myself to go away. Yeah? That's not very nice, is it? I said, invite the feeling in. When the feeling comes, you say to it, please come in, sit down, have a cup of tea. Please stay, tell me all your troubles. She's like, no, I couldn't do that. I said, go on, you can do it. She said, no, I couldn't. So eventually she managed to do that, yeah, to find a feeling of acceptance of that feeling. And she came back to me the next day and she said, that's one of the most powerful things that ever happened to her in her life. After all these years of being afraid of this feeling, now she can see it like she could see this feeling was like a troubled child. I said, you said you'd be like the mother for that feeling. You could just love it and accept it and care for it. Yeah? No matter what. And so she brought that attitude of love and kindness into her meditation. And the feeling was still there. It didn't magically make it go away. But there was an acceptance there. That meant she could bear it, she could carry on. So when we come to meditation, don't try to push the feelings away. And don't try to stop thinking. It's ridiculous. Of course you can't stop thinking, as if you can sit in meditation and stop thinking. It's crazy. This is the number one source of suffering among meditators, is the idea that you can sit down and make yourself stop thinking. Of course you can't. Your mind is a thinking machine, right? It's been designed to think since as long as you can remember. Think, on and on and on it goes. You can't just sit there and make all that go away. You can't make it stop, right? But you can do a few things. One thing you can do is learn to accept your thinking. It's okay. Yeah. People are like, oh, I couldn't stop my mind from thinking. So what? Everybody's thinking. There's what, 100 something people in this room. Everybody's sitting there thinking. It's okay. Life goes on. Thinking is all right. Yeah. The only problem is that your mind doesn't become very peaceful as long as that thinking is there. So you don't worry about making yourself stop thinking, but just become peaceful. So one analogy I give for people like this is imagine that you're at home and there's some kids in your home and they're running around playing and they're yelling and they're screaming around the home and it's really noisy and they're really annoying you. What do you do? Do you say to the kids, sit down and shut up? Well, that might work for a few minutes, yeah. But soon enough they'll get up and they'll start running around again. Why? Because it's their nature. That's what kids do. So instead you say, go over to the park and play in the park. Yeah? They can go and play cricket in the park or go and play, mess around there. They can run around as much as they like. They can scream as much as they like. It's okay. That's what parks are for. They're making just as much noise as they were, even more. But it's okay. So when we come to the mind, the Buddha said when you develop the mind, especially when you develop loving kindness, you develop a mind which is like the ocean. Yeah? You develop a mind that is like the sky. You develop a mind that's like the great earth. Very beautiful images. Yeah? In English we have this terrible idiom that we say you develop concentration. Terrible. No, you don't develop concentration. They use concentration for samadhi, and they use one-pointedness for ekagata. Yeah, but that's not. The Buddha didn't talk about one-pointedness. Ekagata doesn't mean one-pointedness. Ekagata means a mind that's like the ocean, a mind that is vipulena, mahagatena, apamanena, with a mind that's vast, abundant, measureless. Right? Does that sound like one-pointed to you? This is not one-pointed. Yeah. This is a mind that is infinite. Yeah? And when you have a mind that is abundant and vast, then a couple of little thoughts playing around in the background or whatever, never mind. So when we come to the practice of meditation, if we think that we can develop loving-kindness meditation, and we begin that loving-kindness meditation by hating parts of ourselves. We begin, may all beings be happy, and I hate my own thoughts. May all beings be happy, and I hate my own emotions. May all beings be happy, and I hate myself. How successful do you think that's going to be? How far do you think we're going to get? So the first thing we have to do is learn to accept. All of these things is okay. You don't worry about it. It's not your problem. It's just conditions. The mind that wants to control these things is just the self. It's just that ego, that narcissism that says, I am in control. Yeah? Ahankara. The Pali or Sanskrit word, ahankara. I doing. Mamankara, me doing. I am in control. I'm going to make this happen. I'm going to make my mind peaceful. I'm going to make myself happy. I'm going to do this. I. You let go. It's okay. It's much easier letting go. You know, everyone has this strange idea. Everyone tells me, oh, it's so hard. I started noticing this a couple of years ago. I was in Malaysia and I was going from one Dhamma center to the other, and people would say to me, oh, Bhante, it's so hard. And I'd say, no, it's easy. They say, oh, no, it's really hard. That's easy. Letting go is easy. They say, no, it's hard. What do you think? Do you think letting go is easy or hard? It's easy. You know, when I arrived in Germany, when I got off the plane, I had my monk's bag. And, you know, the monks sort of travel with a bag like Venerable Nisarana or the other monks. I left mine in the car. And I got off the plane and I just had this one bag. And the people who picked me up said, oh, you know, is that all your luggage? You know, you're traveling very light. And I said to them, no, you don't understand. That's not my luggage. That's everything I own in the entire world. It fits into my monk's bag. Yeah. Except for one thing. I've got a spare set of dentures, which I keep in the monastery in Bodhinyana. That's it. Okay? Apart from one spare set of false teeth, everything fits into one bag. So I'm 47 years of age, not much to show for it. I'm a great, must be a great disappointment to my parents. But letting go is easy. And people say to me, oh, letting go is so hard. But it's not. You should try it one day. Just give everything away and walk along the street with nothing. See what happens. And not only... Not only is letting go easy, I can prove it. It's a biological fact that letting go is easy. Yeah? Why? Well, when I was in high school, we learned some basic biology, and we learned that in our body we have two sets of muscles, right? You have the holding on muscles and the letting go muscles. Yeah? So you've got one set of muscles in your hand for holding and one set for letting go. Yeah? Which ones are stronger? The holding muscles are strong, right? The holding muscles are strong. The letting go muscles are weak. Why? Because holding on is difficult. That's why you need strong muscles to do it. Yeah? Letting go is easy. There's nothing to it. Yeah? Just like that. Everything's gone. Holding on is such hard work. Yeah? You think about it in your life. How much work do you have to do to hold on to your job? To hold on to your family? To hold on to your house? To hold on to your car? To hold on to your career, to hold on to your reputation, to hold on to all of these things. Imagine what would happen if you didn't hold on to any of those things. Life would be a bit different, wouldn't it? Yeah. But the good thing, you don't have to let go of everything all at once, yeah? You do it little bit by little bit. And so you look at what is causing suffering and you let go of those things. Yeah? Little bit by little bit. And this is something which is not just we think of it from a Buddhist perspective, we think of it in terms of meditation and our own individual practice and so on. But there's more to it than that. Because it has much wider social implications. I was quite struck. Was recently I was in Austria, and I was at an interfaith conference, and there was one panel there about the environment, and one of the speakers was talking about climate change, and he was talking about how the damage and the destruction that we've wreaked on the environment because of our greed. How this beautiful planet that we live in, with beautiful water and beautiful plants and trees, everything that we want, yeah, and we're destroying it because of our greed. This is something the Buddha spoke about many years ago. It's not just a new notion. Even in the Buddha suttas, in the Aganya Sutta, for example, the Buddha talks about how human greed leads to the destruction of the environment. And in many of the Buddha stories, we find similar themes. In the Samudravani Jajataka is another example. And when this fellow was talking at this conference, he said, you know, we're going to have to start looking as a society, as a human society, we're going to have to start looking. And then he paused for a moment. He was searching for a word. And then he said the word nekama. So that's how I knew he was a Buddhist. He said he couldn't think of the English word, so he said nekama. He said, renunciation. Ah. So renunciation is not just something that leads to happiness for the individual. It also leads to happiness in society and perhaps even leads to the survival of our society. We can't just keep on being greedier and greedier and using more and more and more. We can't just keep looking out for ourselves. We have to expand our minds. From the Buddhist point of view, you know, we have this the basis of metta always is sabbe sattā bhavantu sukhinātā. May all beings be happy. It's absolutely amazing. When in Buddhism, we take these things for granted sometimes. It's part of it. We just something we chant and we know, oh yes, we know, sabbe sattā, all beings be happy. But it's such a radical and powerful notion. The basis of Buddhist ethics, Buddhist loving kindness and compassion and concern, sabbe sattā, all beings, irrespective of race or nation or creed or gender, any of those things. None of those things matter. Well, the only thing that matters is who feels, who suffers. So if we want to act truly out of metta, then we act not just out of consideration for our own benefit, but for the sabbalokahita, the benefit of the whole world. So this is something that we, that doesn't come in just a moment, and it doesn't come magically. It's not just, I mentioned before about the idea of IQ, that IQ is not just something that people have. It's something that people do. It's something that you can develop. And loving kindness is exactly the same. It's not just that some people are kind people and other people are unkind people. Loving kindness is a choice. It's your choice what you do with your life. Are you going to act from a place of love? Or are you going to act from a place of hate? Can't blame anybody else. No matter what has happened to you, no matter what situation you've been in or what the conditions are, you can always choose to act from a place of love. We always have that choice. So these things are conditioned. They're conditioned by training. How do we use our mind? What choices are we going to make every moment of every day? Okay, so that's probably enough for the talk for this afternoon. We maybe have some questions.